I began reading Frank Wilderson's Afropessimism in the summer of 2020 with a multiracial virtual reading group that unceremoniously disbanded after 3 or 4 sessions. It's a shame because if we had made it to the 5th chapter, The Trouble with Humans, we would have encountered Wilderson at his clearest and most concise, and the real conversation could have gotten going, you know? Now I return to Afropessimism with questions about the politics of play and also performance and DIY projects. So play as performance and DIY projects. How do minoritarians, specifically those sentenced to social death, and we'll talk about what social death is, how can we get to play? And how can play demonstrate the logical illogic of social death and the space-time continuum of slaveness? How does Afropessimism frustrate the impulse to treat play as neutral and as a universal method of generating pro-social behavior and emotional regulation? Or play as neutral fun? Or more urgently, what are forms of play that disorder the space-time of anti-Blackness and transport us to space-times of liberation within the multiverse? Are my questions better answered through Afrofuturism, Black quantum futurism, Afro-nowness, or any other gatherings of Black futurists? How can Black future-making work avoid a fetishizing and extractive relationship with Black cultural production, and thus replicating the values of techno-capitalism and shadow slavery? So Afropessimism. Let's talk about it. In Afropessimism, Frank Wilderson outlines the key tenets of Afropessimism, a meta theory, so it's like a theory on theory, that attempts to holistically and accurately describe the tandem. So tandem, think of that as two sides of a coin. So the tandem ontological categories of Black and slave that originated in the transatlantic slave trade. He uses Afropessimism to probe the uniquely anti-Black violence that generates and maintains the categories of Black and slave into slavery's hereafter. So the formation of slavery as a system of economic power and cultural, spiritual, physical domination, right? All the way through until after the Emancipation Proclamation, you know? Till now. The violence of slavery bars Black people from humanity and subjecthood and locks us into the temporal spatial condition of social death and the category of non-human. Wilderson's methods are autobiography, not of theory. Throughout the book, he shares a series of formative, traumatic racial episodes from various periods of his life. As a youth raised by Black intellectuals in an elite white Minnesotan enclave, as a Marxist political operative under FBI surveillance, and as a scholar navigating academia. Wilderson takes pains to point out the inadequacies of Marxism and other theoretical discourses to account for the libidinal and political aspects of anti-Black violence. Essentially, to be human, capital H, is to not be the black slave. He posits that non-human, the black slave, and the human have a host-parasite relationship different from a worker, capitalist, indigenous settler, or immigrant citizen relationship, because there is not, nor will there ever be, a tenable path to redemption through a restoration of rights, property, or status. But what's juiciest to me is Wilderson's work with time through the analogy of narrative. To quote Wilderson, Afro-pessimism is premised on an iconoclastic claim that blackness is coterminous with slaveness. Blackness is social death, which is to say that there was never a prior moment of penitude, never a moment of equilibrium, never a moment of social life. Blackness as a paradigmatic position, rather than as an ensemble of identities, cultural practices, or anthropological accoutrements, cannot be disimbricated from slavery. The narrative arc of the slave, who is black, capital B, unlike the generic slave who may be of any race, is not a narrative arc at all, but a flat line of historical stillness, a flat line that moves from disequilibrium to a moment in the narrative of faux equilibrium, to disequilibrium restored and or rearticulated. I want to think about that image. The image of equilibrium and the narrative arc. It's interesting that he's saying it's a flat line. I think that visual of the narrative arc, of countering the visual of the narrative arc. But when I hear equilibrium, I think about a metronome. I think about a clock ticking seconds, you know? And I think about seconds, and I think about the clock, and I think about the mechanism in the clock. Who made the clock? The clock, it's a timepiece. And timepieces are technology, and clocks are timepieces for techno-capitalism. The development of technologies to enable and spread capitalist economic systems. And the culture and societies produced from those economic systems. Anyway, I return to the question, you know, of how can play demonstrate the logical illogic of social death, right? In the space-time continuum of anti-blackness. So I'm game, I'm listening. But I clock some problems with Wilderson. He obviously doesn't want to think about disability, queerness, transness, as other categories of a priori non-humans. These identities or social categories include people who are violently and habitually cast out of the category of human. I'm interested in some concepts that he goes through in the book, but Wilderson seems stuck, like shipwrecked or gobsmacked, just surveilling the wreckage. This wreckage is so disorienting and nauseating, he can't make out the other wrecks around him. At least with that image, that's the grace I can afford him. I don't know. So I bring these thoughts to conversations with my friends, in addition to my studio practice and the conversations I have in grad school. Frank Wilderson tells this story about taking a post 9/11 airport shuttle ride at 4 a.m. in the morning. It's dark. The driver isn't sure that Wilderson's actually his customer. When Wilderson gets into the car, he sees that the driver is Pakistani, an immigrant, and that the other passengers in the car are a white professional couple. There's a triangular dynamic that's immediately set up. And as he's playing to this dual audience, something interesting emerges. They talk about obliquely how the U.S. is an inhospitable place for immigrants like the driver, and also for Black Americans like Frank Wilderson. The exchange goes, "I don't know why I came to this country." And Wilderson says, "Yeah, I don't know why either." And the driver says, "If I could go home, I would." And Wilderson says, "Yeah, me too." This story hit me because I grew up in a triangular dynamic. Here's my mom talking about her identities.
Yeah. Identify myself as an African.
Okay.
First of all, and economically, I can see I'm middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the other one again?
Do you identify with like an ethnicity? Like, is being African your ethnicity, or is being African like your race? What is that?
Yeah, mean? My race, you know, yeah. And. I'm a born Liberian.
Mm-hmm.
And love my family, love, you know, helping my family, and I made it to the United States, you know, land of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that I made it here.
Yeah.
And because of my coming here, it made a lot of difference in the life of me and my family back home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So do you think your identity as an immigrant is also important to you too?
Yeah.
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 You're also, I mean, you're also a mom.
Yeah. Also a mom. Yeah. Two beautiful girls.
Yeah. I forgot to mention the part about making them feel safe, making the audience feel safe, making the white people feel safe, right? That's like the credo or motto that Wilderson's parents taught him to keep in mind whenever engaging with white people, to keep him safe, right? They were professionals, academics in Minnesota, so they know what they're talking about. It's a strategy that's kept them safe and their sons safe enough. A relative safety, some idea of safety, but let's not get it twisted. There's still harm being done. I think about like being in clown class with my instructor, Donna Oblongata. And we are learning a type of physical theater making, essentially, or physical performance making, right? All performance is physical, right? but I had come to that class because I wanted to make experimental work that was wacky and weird, but did not know how to make that work without betraying the allegiance I have with audiences. or without portraying my sense of self, my sense of propriety, my sense of sanity, my sense of respectability. To be able to do performance and come away knowing that I knew what I had done on stage and that it was intentional, and I led myself and the audience through an experience that was intentional and safe, even if it felt scary at points, right? And I haven't thought about that in a long time. It's there, right? It's knowledge that's there, but I haven't thought about that in a while until now. Like, where else have I heard this idea of keeping people safe? So in the class, the idea of safety is essentially what makes the work so potent and rich. It's acknowledging that you and your audience are connected, and you're connected through presence, and the way that you highlight presence are through things like, or strategies, methods, like breathing. Donna would say, if you're not breathing, your audience isn't breathing. And if you don't know what to do, just breathe and be present in the moment with your audience, with yourself. Even when you think that you're going out of control or you don't know what to do next, just breathe. Breathe your way through it. And then you can do things like play with that breath. Breathe hard, breathe slow, breathe stoppingly, breathe in an unsure way. We also weren't allowed to use dialogue. We weren't allowed to use language, spoken language, as clowns. So we're just focusing on our physicality, and breath is an engine, as they say, the thing that sort of motivates your movement and your actions and keeps everything connected and going and flowing. And so when you decide to do something on stage that makes the audience worry about your safety, it's not just about being like, ta-da, you thought I wasn't safe, but I actually was safe. Your audience doesn't get to breathe. And then what experience are they having? Now, not everybody believes in that, but I saw some really good work coming out of that workshop. So there's something happening there that makes sense and works and makes me feel comfortable enough, brave enough, sound enough to step outside of myself.
Like, yeah. Certain relationships I value because they don't play, and I'm like, that's okay. Like, you have a certain special role in my life, but like my deep intimate people, I was like, we gotta play. We gotta play. We gotta, because life is too short. Okay, like the world is trying to play me every day. So like, I need to like.
Hey, Tony. That was Tony. Tony Moten. My black clown sibling. You'll hear more from them later. We had a sprawling conversation about clowning, blackness, play, and the heartbreaks and the joys of figuring out how to find our playmates in life and in study. Tony went to a unnamed clown school. And yeah, they have some really great points about the difficulties of finding je and play and joy at clown school.
I'm not going to be gracious. I'm just like, there are so many moments where I'm just like, damn, y'all don't know what to do. Like, y'all have never had to deal with like these sorts of like complexities around like identity and around whatever. So like, how is anyone going to like trust anybody? Like how, like there's no way for that spirit to come out. Like,
yeah, yeah.
The show was blocked, you know? And so I'm just like, I had to find that either outside of the space, like period, or just like with people who like weren't artists. And it's like, I definitely believe, or like not even artists, it's people who weren't in my whatever field that is.
Sure.
A Black performer stares into a mirror. A Black performer stares into a camera, applying face paint. A Black performer stares into a camera, applying face paint. A Black performer stares into a camera, applying face paint. A Black performer speaks into a microphone, applying face paint. A performer, Black, applies white face paint. Finishing application. They powder themselves and sweep off the excess with a fan brush. Make them feel safe. Mouthing the words, working them from the lips to the jaw, around the cheeks, up and down, and out the ears. Make them feel safe. Make them feel safe. Make them feel safe. Hi, how are you doing? Make them feel safe. Brush down. Work on safe. Work on it. Safe, 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 safe. Make them feel safe. Make them feel safe. Feel them. You know, feel them and make them safe. The face paint rings out nature's warning colors. Hello. I'm not saying I don't feel safe, but I assure you, safe I am not. Make them feel safe. Hi, welcome to Safe. We're here to make you feel safe. Hi. Hey. Welcome. Make them feel safe. I'm not safe, but I'm here to make you feel safe. I don't feel safe. I feel you. I feel you. I feel you. Girl, I feel you, but you're safe. And I don't feel safe. Make them feel safe. Make them feel safe. Make them feel safe. You're safe. I'm safe. I'm safe for you. You're safe. I'm safe. We're all safe too. Make them feel safe. Make them feel safe. Make them feel, make them feel, make them feel safe. In this chapter, I'm going to think about performance through audience. Being an audience member is my primary experience of performance. My strong responses to performance, thrill, secondhand embarrassment, agitation, or sleepiness have motivated me to explore it as a medium for myself, as an artist and designer. Performing for an audience is difficult for me, and I want to think through my refusals of performance more here. It's a knotty thing. It's a trust thing. It's many things. And I think I can touch on a lot by talking about a visit to the National Aviary in Pittsburgh with my mom and my sister. Because after that trip, I finally felt able to ask my mom three questions I've wanted to ask her for months. How does she identify? How is she misidentified? And how have her identities changed since migrating to the United States? The question of audience is about our ever-changing fluid relationships with our origins and destinations, the people we encounter, and the points in between. I took my family to the aviary because my mom loves birds and collected little bird figurines when I was growing up. It wasn't a massive collection, but some nice pieces were tucked in the living room or the dining room growing up. At the National Aviary in Pittsburgh, we saw a presentation called African Adventure, sponsored by AAA, about African birds. The program was hosted by two people. One was an unassuming white woman, I'll call her Sarah. The other was Jabadi, who was represented as the disembodied voice of, I'm assuming, a Black African. We heard him, but we did not see him on the video wall or in the room. Of course, there were birds, many, many beautiful birds. So our performers were Sarah, Jabadi, and the birds. The audience was me, my mom, my sister, and lots of white families. Make them feel safe. So we were the only Black people in the room, which isn't surprising to me. During the pre-show, my mom and I answered on-screen trivia questions to ourselves, and then the lights dimmed. The title sequence played on the video wall, definitely using that stupid African safari font. There was probably a selection from The Lion King, and they definitely played Toto's Africa during Sarah's entrance. Yeah, they did that shit. They really did that. Sarah and Jabari shared interesting tidbits about African wildlife, discussing the incredible biodiversity of Africa and the uniqueness of its creatures, the kind of bent towards getting people to think about and care about ecological conservation broadly. I think they maybe brought up issues like the mining of precious metals used to produce things like our cell phones, and how that results in habitat loss for these species. A specific bird would appear on screen in its natural habitat, and then moments later, it would waddle or glide onto stage. They were really working to get these white American families to care about a land far, far away. I just don't know how productive it was. And overall, it was an upsetting and delightful experience, like how I imagine Disneyland is.
You remember when we went to the aviary when you and Dorothy were visiting, and we saw that that feature, that show about Africa and African birds?
Yeah, what did Gawa narrating?
Yeah, how did you feel about that? Like, how did you feel about being African? We were the only Black people in that audience.
Yeah, I felt good about it, though, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt good about it.
What did you like about, how Africa was represented in that?
Well, represented good in the God. I was narrating his story. He really did good.
Yeah, I thought it was strange that we didn't see a picture of him at all. We only heard his voice.
Yeah, we only heard his voice. I already wanted to see him, the person that was doing the talking.
Right?
Yeah, but we only heard his voice. But he did good at narrating it, you know, but at least we could have seen his face.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been even great to have an actual, actual African in person there talking about Africa. Because the person who was there is, you know, I'm assuming a white American woman. Yeah, I had mixed feelings about that because I did learn a lot and the animals that they showed us were beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But it just felt strange for them to be talking about Africa with no Africans actually, like,
yeah, showing their faces or showing the face of the person that you're narrating the story.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, that felt strange. Well, the presentation was good, but that's the only part about it I didn't like too.
Okay,
that so they didn't show the face of this guy,
mm-hmm,
that was narrating the story. Mm-hmm. Because my thing after first, like, they were going to show him first and,
right,
and introducing, you know,
mm-hmm,
and say, you know, this is Sangara Guru and whatever, you want to tell her about this.
That's his name? You just call his name?
Yeah, Sangara Guru, that's a Liberian.
Okay, I think his name is Jabari or something like that.
Yeah.
What does Sangawolo mean?
I can't really tell you.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that would have been nice. It would have been nice, I think.
Yeah. You know, introduce him before you even start talking.
Maybe it's great that Jabari Sangawolo wasn't there, that he wasn't real, because in his absence in body and image, African adventure puts it on us, the audience, to conjure him. Conjure your own African. Actually, that's a great idea. What does your Jabari, the African park ranger, look like? Does he have a warm, gap-toothed smile? Beard or no beard? Is he dressed like a park ranger or someone else? Does he match Sarah? Or is his uniform a little different? Something more African. Does he look like one of the Africans on the poster of The Gods Must Be Crazy? Does he look like one of the Jamaicans from Cool Running? Like fun-loving, or stately like James Earl Jones? Or maybe more like Eddie Murphy as Prince Akeem, charming and bland. Maybe Chadwick Boseman as T'Challa. Urgent, worried, like he's got a kingdom to save. Awesome. Now you've conjured your own African. He's here right now, watching us and listening to us. Let's welcome him. Jambo, Jabari. Habari Gani. Now that Jabari is here, I feel safer to say this. I hate performing. It's training. Ugh, to code switch for different audiences, to mask my behaviors as neurotypical enough, to not be a scary gender non-conforming homo. Just a cool, fun art lady. It's exhausting. And I also hate performing because I don't trust you. I don't have a reason to trust you. Why should I? Have you heard about these things called settler colonialism and capitalism and what they've done to us? Why should I be vulnerable with you? Why should I share what I've got? I'll trust you if we can establish we're in this shit together. Being in the shit together. Yeah. I think it's about generosity and reciprocity of performing, watching, being together. A form of witness or withness. Withness, it's like witness, but there's an H in parentheses after the T. And I first heard of the concept from Sonia Karana. Here she is talking about it.
I'm glad that you asked this question, because when riding on the backs of what some of what Juliana and Victoria have said, I was also thinking of one word. I picked one word when you said witness. In more recent work, I've started to apply the word witness. So the H is in is in parenthesis. So it's witness, but it's also withness. So with an extremely hyphenated or more awareness of who all make the performance and where the audience then becomes part of it. So for instance, in the Lying Down series, after a point, after many years of doing that as an act, as a gesture, resistance, and I can say 50 other words which would very proudly defend that, it was a question of not just being seen by others as somebody who's lying in public squares, but inviting others to become a part of it, mm-hmm. and what that experience means. And this shift from witness to witness is also a very big shift of who the audience is and who the artist is.
That was the artist Sonia Carana speaking on the artist panel, Bodywork, Performance and Practice at Art Basel, Hong Kong. Let's take this vulnerability up a notch. The only reason for me to be vulnerable here is because having an audience... Yeah, it's erotic. Think about it. I, the performer, just think I'm so fascinating and interesting, right? And the only way for you to, well, the only way for me to know and enjoy my fascinating and interesting nature is by putting myself in relation to you, the audience, through separation and comparison. From me to you, from you to me, and then watching myself through you. So it's like you matter and you don't matter. I need your matter. I'm appropriating your matter.
The erotic is a measure between the beginnings of our sense of self and the chaos and power of our deepest feelings. It is an internal sense of satisfaction to which once we have experienced it, we know we can aspire. Once having experienced the fullness of this depth of feeling and recognized its power, in honor and self-respect, we can require no less of ourselves. Now, it is never easy to demand the most from ourselves, from our lives, from our work. To go beyond the encouraged mediocrity of the society that we live in is always fraught with danger and with fear.
That was the incredible Audre Lorde speaking from her essay, Uses of the Erotic, published in 1978. Another Black clown sibling, Brett Robinson, hey Brett, shared this with me when I asked her for texts about Blackness and clowning. Though Lorde's audience is probably lesbians and feminists, and I'm theoretically one or the other at best, this essay is useful to me because it concretely illustrates the stakes of cultivating deep joy with others in this space-time of anti-Blackness. The measure between our sense of self and the chaos and power of our deepest feelings. I think that embrace of chaos, of desire, our big yes, is the fire, the engine, the passion that allows us to disorder the space-times of anti-Blackness, cis-heteropatriarchy, techno-capitalism, Western hegemony, ableism, speciesism, environmental degradation, transphobia. As we slide between the roles, performances, and audiences we come into. Lorde calls the erotic a bridge. It moves us through. I should probably also think about what's happening when I'm performing with other people, right? Like, not just solo performance. I think with other performers, it's the game that's erotic. Like, finding a rapport, boiling, simmering, watching the mixture foam up, then it hits the fire and hisses, and then you lower the temperature and then you stir it back down. And when it's right, it's right. So yeah, there's like a situation. The situation has rules and a context, and you're fighting your way through it. And yeah, and then maybe you also add that to the thrill of being watched. And boom, performance erotics. The performance ends. I do that thing where I feel sucked. Like, okay. I mean, like, drains, right? That kind. But then I also am, like, reintegrating into some version of myself, which would be false to say this is a version of myself that existed before I entered the stage, because I'm a new person now, right? But anyway, some reintegration process is happening. And as I'm reintegrating, it's like, what the fuck just happened? These people, did they see me? Did I show it to them? What do they want from me? I mean, some people come because they're curious and they like a little savory popcorn kernel to crunch on and roll around their teeth and pick at with their tongue, you know? Yeah, they really want to savor something new. Other people are just there for the vibes, and they like performance vibes, and when they're in this space, when they're in the audience, they are getting to experience parts of themselves they normally don't get to, seeing things they normally don't get to, maybe having some affective, resonant experience where some gesture you did reminded them of something that they haven't thought about in a long time. These thoughts come from me by way of Neha Choksi, who I had a studio visit with a few weeks ago. I asked, like, yeah, how do you get people to look at work that we make, which is just these strange, rhizomatic works that make connections that other people wouldn't readily draw between. Yeah, entities and events. So yeah, like, I do the performance, you have your experience, it's erotic for me, maybe it's erotic for you. I probably could benefit from some aftercare practice. Maybe that's why I hate it so much. It's like the rush.
And this brings me to the last consideration of the erotic for the time being. To share the power of each other's feelings is different from using another's feeling as we would use a Kleenex. And when we look the other way from our experience, erotic or otherwise, we use rather than share the feelings of those others who participate in that experience with us. And use without consent of the used is abuse.
I have pictures that do that and video footage. I don't want to talk about it with you. Yeah. Unless I know you, maybe. Maybe I just haven't had enough good conversations with friends about performance. It's just so vulnerable. And anyway, I think this is why I'm just really drawn to collaboration. Again, being in the shit with somebody. And this is also why I am into more interactive stuff. Yeah, it's a pain in the ass. When I'm in an audience, I'm kind of like, God, I just wanted to sit here. But, strategically employed, artfully employed interaction can just like boost things up all the way and make an unforgettable experience and maybe even a transformative experience where the energy isn't just flowing one way. For me. But even megastars love it when their audience members sing back to them their own lyrics, right? Let's talk about this coloniality thing. Remember the aviary, Sarah, Jabadi, and the birds, and the white families? Let's put that all in context. I'm going to read an excerpt from Catherine Yusoff's A Billion Black Anthropocenes or None. Bear with me. We're going to zoom all the way out. And it's a long one.
And I'm Catherine Yusoff. I'm a reader in human geography at Queen Mary.
And she introduced me to the concept of critical geology. Her work is transparently informed by Black feminists and Afro-pessimist theory, and she writes about geologic life and geologies of race. In chapter 2, Golden Spikes and Dubious Origins, Yusoff says, "The origins of the Anthropocene are intensely political in how they draw the world of the present into being and give shape and race to its world-making subjects." But first, what is the Anthropocene? Have you heard of it? I'm going to read an explanation from the National Geographic website. Shout out to scams. Shout out to magazine scams of old. My family had National Geographics in our living room. And my dad, I'm assuming, purchased the special, covers that you could put your different volumes into. Anyway, officially the current epoch is called the Holocene, which began 11,700 years ago after the last major ice age. However, the Anthropocene epoch is an unofficial unit of geologic time used to describe the most recent period in Earth's history when human activity started to have a significant impact on the world's climate and ecosystem. The word Anthropocene is derived from the Greek word anthropo, for man, and scene, for new, coined and made popular by biologist Eugene Stormer and chemist Paul Crutzen in the year 2000. Scientists still debate whether the Anthropocene is different from the Holocene, and the term has not been formally adopted by the International Union of Geological Sciences, IUGS. The international organization that names and defines epochs, the primary question that the IUGS needs to answer before declaring the Anthropocene an epoch is if humans have changed the Earth's system to the point that is reflected in the rock strata. Geological. To those scientists who do think the Anthropocene describes a new geological time period, the next question is, when did it begin? Which is also widely debated. A popular theory is that it began at the start of the Industrial Revolution of the 1800s, when human activity had a great impact on carbon and methane in Earth's atmosphere. Others think that the beginning of the Anthropocene should be 1945. This is when humans tested the first atomic bomb and then dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan. The resulting radioactive particles were detected in soil samples globally. In 2016, the Anthropocene Working Group agreed that the Anthropocene is different from the Holocene and began in the year 1950, when the Great Acceleration, a dramatic increase in human activity affecting the planet, took off. But our dear Catherine Yusoff is saying, wait, pause. Like, let's look at this debate. As the mineralogical punctuation events and geologic processes, the Anthropocene names an empire that is not yet at its end. And so any account of the gravity and tense of that trajectory accounts for and reorganizes understandings of ongoing geosocial processes. Origins, then, are another word for an account of agency or trajectory of power. Geology is a transactional zone in which ideas of origins, subjectivity, and matter are intertwined with historical materialist roots that span a genealogy of dispossession, uprooting, and extreme violence. In thinking about geology as an intensely extractive praxis, there is a need to question what Eve Tuck and K. Wayne Yang call, quote, moves to innocence, settler moves to innocence, and the claims about the newly found consciousness that permeates anthropocentric scientific and social scientific discourse. This is the claim that humanity has failed to understand the violent repercussions of colonialism, industrialization, or capitalist modes of production, and that these violences were an unforeseen byproduct, oops, or excess of these practices, and not a central tenet of them. Aptly, capturing the geomatrix of racial formations and land dispossession under colonialism, W.E.B. Du Bois defined whiteness as the ownership of the earth forever and ever.
You said you want to go down there?
No, there's one down there.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Yeesh. Yusoff continues. This attempt to absolve the positionality of Western colonial knowledge and extraction practices, while simultaneously reinforcing and resettling them in a new territory, a Western frontier of pioneers armed with eco-optimism and geoengineering, indicates a desire to overcome coloniality without a corresponding relinquishing of the power it continues to generate in terms of who gets to formulate, implement, and speak to or of the future.
Oh, it's a ribbon that's in there, or a piece of paper. They have, like,
the in this telling, the Anthropocene is the white man's overburden.
Wow. Like, for me, like, when I think about, like, my favorite things with clowning, when I was just, like, getting into especially like Buffon and like Grotesque, and they're explaining some history with like Buffon. It's like, oh, you're performing for the king and you have to make fun of him in the right way. And if you don't, they'll kill you. And I'm just like, oh, what is this? Like, what is this whole, like that's not the same context anymore.
Right.
But also like, even within that, it's like, what does it mean to like speak quote unquote truth to power? Like, you're trying to make fun of the monarch for how shitty they possibly are while making them laugh about it. And it's like, here I am in, at the time, like, what, 2020, 2019, really just like,
yeah,
we're going to make fun of white liberals in my audience. And I'm kind of just like, what is this? Like, what is, and I didn't do it in a way I really wanted to, but it was just like,
yeah.
Huh. Like, is this still, what's the future of this? Like, what is like, speaking truth to power, making fun of power now, like there's no king trying to kill me, but like there's these white people trying to be nice. I don't know. Like, I just don't know like what, you know, like.
The Anthropocene is the white man's overburden. Allow me to riff on this. I appreciate this text. It's thick, dense, you could say. And what I value about it is how it takes something that seems benign, maybe, maybe benevolent, really, like defining a new geological epoch, right? And points at the politics of that, points to how this is a continuation of hierarchies, of, yeah, superiority that came to power through settler colonialism and slavery, is with the rise of Western Empire. And so it's like, hey, techno-capitalism, we did that, right? And everybody like wants to be like us, but dang, we gotta change it and be a good example to the rest of the world. Now, what does that sound like? What does that remind you of? It reminds me of the aviary. It reminds me of being the only Black family in that room amongst white families. We are taught about the incredible biodiversity of Africa, and its animals and landscapes, climates, and all that's being threatened by mining of the very materials used to make your cell phones. Never is there a mention of, I don't know, colonization or slavery as these earth-changing events that have disturbed those ecosystems and environments. Nor is there mention of the present and the climate activists who are currently fighting and have been fighting against things like extraction in their countries. Instead, we were given this sanitized story with beautiful animals and beautiful landscapes and no Africans, except for the ones in the audience, sorry. And yeah, check out these birds. They're flying around you right now. They're real. These birds are real. Audience, these birds are real. We're talking about real birds here. Look at these birds. These birds could die. These birds could die. You could just like not see these birds ever again. Isn't that a bummer, right? Give these birds a dollar. I'm not joking. At the end of the presentation, they had two interactive moments. One where some pre-selected audience members held these like meat skewers out for birds to swoop in and take. My mom didn't want to do that. And the other thing that everyone could participate in, should you choose, is to donate $1 or $5 to a really beautiful, intelligent crow who would take your donation and shove it into a box. And if you donated $5, you could get a little souvenir. And so I ran my happy ass down there and gave that crow $5. It caught at me. It shoved my money into that box. And I went and got myself a reusable straw, because at the aviary, they do not have straws because they are a threat to the birds. So now I have a National Aviary metal straw in my possession. So what do we do in the face of this relentless, insidious storytelling? Because geological constructs like the Anthropocene are powerful narratives that affirm, cohere, like stick together, and continue Western hegemonic power. We can tell a joke when people keep getting the story wrong And we can speak untruths to the power they're trying to hold over us when our boldness surpasses our own desire for safety. Like my mom.
And we so had a joke, we say, yeah, the American ambassador living the biggest dream of Rovia.
Like the tree from the Lion King.
Yeah, exactly. So that's how we so answer. They say, the American ambassador living the biggest dream in Africa. Oh, one time, one of them asked him, I said, oh, yeah, we live in a tree. I said, we go to school in a tree. Our teacher, they're all hanging on the branches. And we all hang on the branches and learn. And she was just sitting there looking at me because I know she asked me the dumb question, so I gave her a dumb answer back.
Mm. But remember, there are new saviors. So how does the bouffon, the clown, evade having their transgressive, desirous, creative power being siphoned off by empire? Let's think back to Lourdes erotics.
Recognizing the power of the erotic within our lives can give us the energy to pursue genuine change within our world, rather than merely settling for a shift of characters within the same weary drama. For not only do we touch our most profoundly creative source, but we do that which is female, that which is self-affirming in the face of a racist, patriarchal, and anti-erotic society. I would like us to keep in touch with those deepest feelings that we have, and perhaps it will help us bridge some of the very real differences and some of the very real ways in which we see our course separately. Thank you.
So there's eagles in the hall. I don't know if that means there's eagles here or if that's just the name. Oh, this is just a seating area. So yeah, there's more this way.
I want to make a lion dance because I want to design an experience to foster bravery where you do it and you can address your thing that you want to be brave about. Like as a group moving together, we're generating that energy and power together so you can just go and do your fucking thing. I get real energy, like undeniable energy from moving in a collective. And my hope is that there's some way to get that good collective energy without being bogged down by the collective politics. And maybe just, you know, just do some dancing it out real quick.
Yeah.
I have like two thoughts because one, I'm just like, this anarchist thinker, Emma Goldman, and she's like, I just found out she said this, I'm paraphrasing more, but she's like, if I can't dance in it, it's not a revolution I want to be a part of. And I'm just like, okay, let me.
Hell yeah. It.
I was like.
See, I didn't really think she said that.
Here are some other follies for good measure. Immigrant Mom Comedy Hour. All right? It's not comedians doing impressions of their immigrant mothers. No, it's immigrant moms doing impressions of their kids, roasting them, and everybody could get it. Everybody.
My favorite room in the aviary. Yeah, I could just spend an hour in here.
A gender optional clown jam. Just come on down if you're down to clown and we can play some games. All right? Black and Gold Bird Experience. This is an audio experience, and so there's like no birds present, and at some point you have to eat what birds eat, and you can't use your hands. Or maybe you have to like clean yourself off without soap. I don't know, working on that. And last,
you wanna go down there?
No, there's one down there.
Certainly not like the last ever idea. And last, arts and crafts done. I'll be your threatening art lady person for a handsome fee.
A ribbon that's in there, or a piece of paper. They had like decorations in the cages. Yeah. It's ripping up.
Yeah.
Wow. It's a peacock pheasant.
Hello. Look at that tail.